So today we'll talk about causal structure, the causal structure of space-time and singularities, horizons and things like that, and things that are even weirder than time travel. See, general relativity allows for a lot of weird stuff to happen. We don't expect that nature actually makes use of all these things, but it does allow it. And there's something that's even weirder than time travel, believe me. So, causal structure and singularities. Here's the thing that general relativity would allow and is weirder than time travel. We say, and here's the definition, we say that a space-time given by differential manifold and a metric is time-orientable if at each point of the space-time we can separate the non-space-like vectors into two classes. One is future-directed and one is past-directed. In such a way that this separation is continuous in the space-time manifold. You see, when we say that a vector is time-like, then, well, it could be pointing into the future, it could be pointing into the past. Time-like doesn't tell us which of the two it is. And general relativity, in principle, allows the description of space-times for which it is not possible to say whether a vector is pointing to the future or to the past. This would mean that the space-time that is described here is not time-orientable. That, I think, is weirder than time travel. So we say that the space-time is time-orientable if none of this trouble arises. Now, how would it look like that a space-time is not time-orientable? Well, let's use our trusted Coke can again. So imagine that the manifold is given by this surface here. And imagine these are the light cones. Okay, I'm just sketching here light cones. And imagine that they go like this and they tilt. And as you go around, it's not displayed here, but as you go around the can, the light cones actually, in effect, rotate by 180 degrees in a smooth fashion. And you come back and, well, now it's rotated, but the whole thing was smooth, right? So the light cones smoothly rotate as you go along around the manifold here. But if you thought that, let's say, up is the future, then you continuously go around, you find that, no, wait, down is the future, and up is the past. So you wouldn't be able to distinguish future and past in this way.
Mm-hmm. So for this one, am I supposed to think that the two-dimensional strip is a Möbius strip where I include the time direction?
No, it's not actually a Möbius strip. It's
like the Tx component is a Möbius strip.
Yeah, but topological is not a Möbius strip. It's just a cylinder. The Möbius strip means that you cut it and then you glue it together in the reversed way. No, this is just that you have light cones which slowly rotate as you go around.
Can we understand this way? Like for the Möbius strip, the normal vector of the Möbius strip just flips after.
Yes, that's a similarity. That's very close. That's right.
And like this is a time axis.
Yes, in that sense, it's very similar. That's right. But you see, as a manifold, that's not a Möbius strip. Okay, so we want there to be the possibility to give an orientation to the future or past in a way that, I mean, for every light cone, we should be able to tell which half is towards the future, which half is towards the past. And as we go around and along the manifold, this assignment of future and past should be continuous. Here's a lemma. If and only if a space-time is time-orientable, then there exists a smooth, non-vanishing, time-like vector field, V, on the manifold. Where the point is it's got to be smooth and non-vanishing. So imagine there is such a V. Imagine given is a vector field which is non-vanishing and it's time-like. Well, if we have such a vector field that's non-vanishing and time-like, then we can define at every point of the manifold the future-directed vectors as opposed to the past-directed vectors relative to our V. Because basically this, we can say that V points towards the future, and that determines what we say about every other time-like vector, whether it points towards the future or whether it points towards the past. So if such a vector, time-like vector field V that never vanishes is given, we can define at each point of the manifold the future-directed vectors xi to be those vectors for which the inner product with V is larger than zero. And then correspondingly, the past-directed vectors would be those for which the inner product is smaller than zero. And of course, we could just swap this as well and just define it the other way around. Now, intuitively, or even technically, this is possible because we can consider a basis in any one of those tangent spaces of the manifold such that the metric is eta mu nu, and such that V is simply V naught 0, 0, 0. Then the inner product between V and any other time-like vector is simply G of V and xi is minus V naught xi naught, because the inner product, the metric, is eta mu nu, right? And since one of the vectors has only an entry here, and eta is diagonal, only that xi naught thing is mattering. And so the sign of xi naught can be used because it is well defined relative to the sign of V in order to tell which vectors are time-like and which vectors are future-pointing and which vectors are pointing towards the past. So in the future, of this course, from now on, in the future, we will only consider time-orientable space-times, and we will always assume without saying that the time orientation has been chosen. Okay, so we have that weird thing out of the way. I mean, in principle, space-time could have this, but let's just assume it doesn't, so that future and past are well-defined. Now, let's consider time-like curves. We're going to do a lot of definitions today, and it will look a little definition-heavy rather than physics-heavy today. But we need to get through all those definitions to get then to the juicy bits eventually, which is proving singularity theorems and understanding horizons better and so on. So let's start with time-like curves. We say that a curve or a path, which is a map from some interval of the real line or the real line itself into the manifold, we say that it is called a future-directed time-like curve if every tangent vector is a future-directed time-like vector. Now, such a path doesn't have to be a geodesic. Right? We're just saying it's some path. So this could be with an engine, doesn't have to be free fall. Also notice that this parameter here, I called t, but that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the time. It's just a parameter. We have the full freedom to parameterize the paths whichever way we want. And in particular, we could choose our parameterization in such a way that sometimes the path seems to speed up, sometimes it seems to slow down. What really matters is just the path itself, the set of points in the manifold. The way we parameterize it doesn't matter at all. Another thing I have to point out is that for future-directed time-like curves, it is not allowed that we parameterize the curve in such a way that it ever comes to a standstill, that gamma dot is equal to zero. And that's because if the vector is equal to zero, it's no longer time-like, because the length would be zero, and that would be called light-like. So if we insist on having a time-like curve, then the parametrization has to be such that the apparent velocity, but it's not the physical velocity, it's just, you know, the path as a function of our artificial parameter, that it never comes to a standstill. Okay, and keep in mind again, this is not about geodesics. Geodesics are just special cases. This could be any path. Now, a curve or path, again, just like before, is called future-directed causal curve instead of time-like curve, causal curve, if each tangent vector is a future-directed non-space-like vector. So this is a slightly larger class of curves now, because now we are allowing that temporarily, or all the time, the speed of light may be reached. In the previous definition for time-like, in this definition that we had earlier, time-like curves, future-directed time-like curves, we required that the tangent vectors are time-like. So in particular, not light-like. Time-like means that the inner product length is negative, not zero. So future-directed time-like curves have tangents that are all time-like. But now the future-directed causal curves may be time-like or light-like. They could be always time-like, they could be always light-like, or they could be mixed. Slower than the speed of light, at the speed of light, or mixed. Causal, and that will come up all the time. When you look up textbooks on general relativity, causal means it's a short way of saying light-like or time-like. Okay? So if you don't want to specify which of the two it is, then say causal. So future-directed causal curve is one for which the tangent vectors are either light-like or time-like. And they can change character between time-like and light-like too. And in this case, we are allowing that the parametrization might come to a halt, so that the path simply basically ends. You could, for example, cook up a parametrization where the parameter runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. It runs along the entire real axis, but the path, the progress you make on the manifold is slowing down, speeding up, slowing down, and eventually it's slowing down and settling to a point. Even though the parameter keeps going, you could just parameterize in such a way that it will reach just a finite value. It's just like the hyperbolic tangent, for example. Right? If you make its argument go to infinity, but the output is just going is bounded by one, right? So, okay. So we are allowing, in particular, that the speed of the path, the apparent speed with respect to our artificial parametrization, could be zero. And similarly, we define path-directed time-like or path-directed causal curves in the same way, except that all tangent vectors now have to be past-directed rather than future-directed, relative to a definition of a time orientation of the kind that we discussed earlier. Now we can look at the past of an event, and we can look at the future of an event. And here, the key definition that we start out with is this. The so-called chronological future of an event P will be denoted by I plus. And the term chronological means, the term chronological future means I plus of P is the set of all those events in space-time which could be reached from the event P by an actual traveler. So it's the set of all those events that can be reached from P on a future-directed time-like curve. So we define future-directed time-like curves. The chronological future is the union of all future-directed time-like curves. So you take your event P, and you take all future-directed time-like curves, and the union of all the events that you can reach in this way is given by I plus P. We will have more definitions of this kind come up, and in order not to confuse it, not to confuse those various definitions, I'd like
the
to give you a mnemonic device
one
to remember this particular definition. Because there's also going to be a causal future and stuff, right? So what's the chronological future? Do you know what a chronometer is? A chronometer is a clock, right? And so here's the mnemonic device. The chronological future of an event P is the set of all those events in space-time that could be reached from P by an actual traveling clock, by an object. Okay? So the chronological future is what can be reached by physical objects from the point P, which means at a speed slower than the speed of light. A clock couldn't travel on the speed of light. Notice that the chronological future of an event P is always an open subset of the manifold. And that's because if gamma is a time-like future-directed curve from P somewhere into the future, then any sufficiently small perturbation of that path is also a time-like future-directed curve starting from P. Remember that the chronological future of an event, as we just defined it, the capital I plus, is defined as the set of events that can be reached by future-directed time-like curves. Now, future-directed time-like curves exclude that possibility because the length of this vector is zero, remember? So gamma dot equal to zero is okay for causal paths, but it's not a time-like path. Time-like paths must have that the length of gamma dot is smaller than zero. So since the condition holds that gamma dot is not allowed to be zero in the previous definition, the event itself is not considered to be in the causal future of itself. Because if you want to travel from P using a future-directed time-like curve, it's never going to take you to P, right? Because you just have to say, stay put there, and that would mean that gamma dot is equal to zero, and so an event is not in its own future. Except if space-time is super weird, which general relativity in principle allows. In principle, an event could be in its own future, but not because there is a path of standing still, which would be excluded by our definition. No, it could be because there is a closed time-like curve through P. In other words, because there could be a time machine. It could be in principle, and space-time doesn't, and general relativity doesn't rule that out. It could be that, starting from P, there is a future-directed, time-like curve that takes you back to P. In which case you would say that, yes, P is in the chronological future of P. Now, we will assume that there are no closed time-like curves for many reasons. This would lead to some difficulties. Now, the case can be made, though, that even though probably there are no closed time-like curves in the universe as a whole, there could be closed time-like curves at very, very small scales, when space-time is quantum fluctuating in a wild way. the causal structure itself may be indefinite at extreme enough scales where space-time's curvature is fluctuating. We will later study the stability of the condition that there are no closed space-like, that there are no closed time-like curves. All right, so we've so far defined the chronological future of an event. And remember, the chronological future is the set of all events that could be reached by actual traveling objects from the event P traveling into the future. Objects such as a chronometer, such as a clock. Now, the so-called causal future of an event is denoted by the letter capital J plus P. And the minus would mean the past, just like here. If we took I minus, it would denote the chronological past of an event. Here we're looking at the causal future of an event. And remember the key word causal, just like on menus, the word Hawaii means pineapple. Here, the word causal means either time-like or light-like. So now we're allowing light-like curves as well. So you start from the event P, and then you consider the union of all events that can be reached on future-directed time-like or light-like or mixed time-like, light-like curves. So in other words, on causal curves. And in this case, we always have that an event is in its own causal future. And that's because now there are paths in the definition of J plus of P, there are paths which are simply staying put, where the parameter moves along, but you're just staying at the same event. And such paths have a vanishing tangent vector whose length is zero, and that is good enough to be called light-like, just because the length is zero. And as we already mentioned, we can define the chronological past of an event, and that's with a minus sign here, and the causal past of an event, that's J with a minus sign. And this is the union, the chronological past of an event is the union of all past-directed time-like curves that go back from P to the past, and the causal past of an event is the union of all paths that start at P and go in the past direction either in a time-like or light-like way. So far, we just looked at individual events and their future and their past. But we can consider the joint future of a bunch of events and the joint past of a bunch of events. So let's say S is a set of events. Then we can define the chronological future and the chronological past, plus and minus signs here, of the set of events as being the union over the chronological pasts or futures of all events in the set, in the set S. And similarly, we define the causal future and causal past of a bunch of events as being the union of the causal futures and causal pasts of all the events of the set. What's also going to be important is the generalization of the notion of light cone. you see, basically, we're talking about light cones here, whatever is going, the future-directed, the causal future of an event is basically its light cone, but the full light cone, the filled light cone. Now, let's look at the light cones themselves. But you shouldn't think of what I'm just saying now as being identical to the light cone. There will be a significant difference, a very subtle thing that has to do with singularities. So let us look now at the boundaries of the chronological future and chronological past of a set of events, and the boundary of the causal future and causal past of a set of events. And they will be denoted with dots on top of the I or on the J. Okay, so I dot is the boundary of the set of the set I, which is the chronological future or past of a set of events S. And similarly for J. With these definitions, we can now, for example, recover the definition of an event horizon that I mentioned earlier. Assume, for example, that S, the set of events that we are, whose future or past we are considering, imagine that S is the set of events traveled by some immortal observer. So there's an observer that keeps going forever, and therefore is tracing out a set of events in space-time. Traveling in space, traveling in time, so you have a one-dimensional world line that this observer is traveling in space-time. And that world line of that immortal observer is S. Then let us look at the causal past of that set S. Right? So S is the world line. And then we look at the causal past J minus of S. So this is the set of all those events that could have influenced our observer at some point. So this is the set of all those events from which there is a time-like or light-like curve that catches up with our observer. And everything that is not in J minus of S is events that our traveler could never learn about, because there is no time-like or light-like curve that travels from those other events to our observer. Ever. Because this is an immortal observer traveling forever. Now, let us look at the boundary of that set of events. So we are looking at the boundary of the causal past of this immortal traveler. And that boundary is what is called the event horizon of that observer. It's because it delineates, it divides the universe into the causal past of our observer, all of which events can affect our observer at some point, because they are time-like or light-like past to the observer. And it divides the universe into this set, the causal past of our observer's timeline, and all other events being events that cannot have ever affected our observer, therefore are beyond the observer's horizon. So the event horizon is that boundary. So J dot minus of S is a compact way of writing the event horizon of an observer. Oh, and by the way, if you considered S to be the timeline of an observer only up to a finite point in time, such as now, could be us, well then, do you know what you get then? What the boundary is of the causal past of an observer, but not run all the way to future infinity, but run only all the way to a finite point in time? Remember that? We had the definition of it.
It's not cosmological horizon.
No?
The particle horizon.
Particle horizon, that's right. It's the particle horizon. That's right.
Sorry, I have a question for this one. So the J minus, the boundary of the causal path, right? If let's say S is just a point, so like say an observer at a point P in Minkowski space, then this set, wouldn't it be just the past-like code?
Yes. Yeah, and the boundary of it, yeah, the boundary of it would be just the past light count. That's right. It would be just the point. Yeah, it would be yeah, it wouldn't be the event horizon, right?
Yeah.
It would be kind of the particle horizon of an event. That's what it would be.
So when you say event horizon, you really mean also
yes.
horizon.
That's right. Yes, you see, assume that S is the set of events traveled by an immortal observer that keeps going forever. That's important. Only then do we call J dot minus of S the event horizon. If S is the timeline of somebody, but who's traveling only for a finite amount of time, then you would call it the particle horizon. But S could be something completely different. In particular, S could be, and we will consider that case, S could be a space-like hypersurface. It could be a patch of a space-like hypersurface. And then it's a very different thing altogether. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about geodesics. So the above definitions did not refer to geodesics. Now, for Minkowski space, it is clear that the set of events reachable by future-directed time-like geodesics is the same as the set of events reachable by future-directed time-like curves altogether. Because in Minkowski space, if you can get to some from one event to another event in a time-like way, there's going to be a geodesic there as well, a time-like geodesic as well. And similarly, the boundary, so that's the future light cone, the actual boundary of the opening of the light cone. I mean, there's the full light cone and there's the boundary of the light cone. So this is the boundary of the light cone. This is, in Minkowski space, clearly of an event P is the set of events reachable by future-directed null geodesics from P. Now, it turns out that this is not in general true in general relativity. It's all of this is true in Minkowski space, but not generally. And in particular, the difference between this being true and not being true is usually the existence of singularities. roughly speaking, because singularities can be in the way of a geodesic. Singularities can also be in the way of just any path. But in any case, locally, the situation even in complicated space-times, is basically just like in Minkowski space. Well, at least locally. So here's the theorem. Assume that P is an event, and that U is some subset of the manifold around the event P, which is a convex normal neighborhood of the point P. And if you remember, we mentioned that, we discussed it earlier, a convex normal neighborhood of an event is a neighborhood in which any two points are connected by a geodesic that's unique. So let's assume that we're dealing here with a convex normal neighborhood of an event. Then we have that the chronological future of an event, which is always defined as the set of the union of all events that can be reached on a time-like path, future-directed time-like path from P, can also be written as the set of events reachable by future-directed time-like geodesics, not just time-like any path, but geodesics suffice, you can get there. And the boundary of it will be the set of events reachable by future-directed null geodesics from P. That's just the boundary of it if you travel at the speed of light. And finally, the set of all events which is in the causal future of an event, but is not in the chronological future of an event, has to be a null geodesic. You see, if it is in the causal future of an event, there must be light-like or time-like curves going from P to the event. This is saying, this is the set of all events that can be reached by time-like curves. So we are saying Q is reachable by time-like or light-like curves, but really not by time-like ones. So therefore, Q is reachable by light-like ones. But in Minkowski space or in a convex normal neighborhood, this means that Q is reachable by a null geodesic. Just like in Minkowski space.
Sorry, why can't you write the last one as just the boundary of J plus?
We'll get to that in a moment. There's a subtle thing there. There's a very subtle thing about the boundaries of I and J. That's what it's all going to be about. Okay, so remember, the chronological future of a set, I plus, is events that can be reached by future-directed time-like curves. The causal future of a set, J plus, is the set of all those events which can be reached from S by a future-directed causal curve, causal meaning null or time-like. And in Minkowski space, we have that the set of all events that can be reached by causal curves, so null or time-like, is the set of all events that can be reached by causal curves, by chronological curves, so time-like curves. And the set of and the boundary of that set. Right? So the light-like curves form the boundary of the set of all time-like curves in Minkowski space. But the subtler thing is that in general that's not so. So what are the properties of the boundary of the chronological future of a set of events S? Now, we have to introduce a new definition, a definition that clearly shows that we are moving to a different kind of sets S. Remember, we considered for the set S either a single event, or we considered S to be the world line of some observer, okay, which either ends at some finite point in time, and then we got the particle horizon with some consideration, or it just keeps on going forever, and then we got the event horizon of our observer. But now we are switching to considering a different kinds of S. I mean, our definitions previously didn't really restrict us to what S's we could choose, and now we start choosing a different kind of S's. And the S's that we, the subsets of the manifold S that we are going to consider now is going to be called achronal subsets, which you can think of as like space-like patches. So a subset Q in the manifold is called achronal, so not chronal, if no two points in that subset can be connected by a future-directed time-like curve. So Q is such that there is no light beam, a time-like curve, so there is no curve that could be traveled by an object that would connect any two elements of that set Q. This means that Q is a set of events which are either space-like to each other or possibly light-like. That's also allowed. But we are not allowing that two elements of Q can be reached from another by a time-like curve. So achronal means no time-like curves connected. So we say that Q is an achronal subset of the manifold if the chronological future of the set of events Q has no intersection with the events Q themselves. It's the empty set. The intersection of these two sets is empty. This is literally just saying that there is no time-like curve that connects any two points. Right? Because the chronological future of Q consists of all those events that can be reached by a time-like curve from Q. But none of the points that can be reached from a time-like curve in Q is itself in Q. That's what achronal means. So we take the chronological future and we intersect it with itself. That's supposed to be empty. So you can think of this as a space-like hypersurface, which may also be light-like, but it cannot be time-like. Then there's this theorem. When S is a subset of M, the boundary of the chronological future of it is, it might be empty, but if it's not empty, then it's an achronal three-dimensional submanifold of the manifold. So the picture to this is this. Imagine S is our set of events that is achronal. So think of them as a piece of a space-like hypersurface. So these are events that are space-like to each other. You can only travel from one to another using space-like curves. Then these events all have a future light cone, right? They all have a future. The time is drawn upwards here. And what I've drawn here is capital I plus of S, which is the chronological future of all these events S. So this is like a space-like hypersurface. And here we have all the events that are in the future of S. So this, in principle, ought to be a line of 45 degrees. And that's a line of 45 degrees. But of course, they don't actually have to be 45 degrees because we did not commit to using a coordinate system in which they look like 45 degrees. But we could always choose a coordinate system in which light beams are at 45 degrees, and that would be the case where they are. Right? So S is an achronal set. I plus is its chronological future, the set of all events that travelers could reach starting from S and then traveling on time-like curves this way. So this is really the chronological future of S. Now the claim is that the boundary of the chronological future of I plus of S, the boundary of all of this, so that thing here and that, the I plus of S, this and this, is three-dimensional, assuming that the space-time is four-dimensional. So it's a three-dimensional submanifold, and it is an achronal. It is achronal. So, for example, in Minkowski space, if S is just a point P, so S is just a point P, then what is the chronological future of it? Well, it's this light cone, but except it doesn't include the 45-degree lines because the chronological future doesn't allow light-like curves. But the boundary of this future light cone is at 45 degrees. And that would be what we are looking at here. And of course, the light cone is light-like. And light-like sets are achronal. Remember that any two points in an achronal set should be or have to be either light-like or space-like to another. And, well, indeed, any two points of the boundary of the light cone are connected by time, I wrote time-like, but it should be, there should be light-like here. Okay, however, in general space-times, the situation is not exactly like that. It is clear that the boundary of the set of all events that can be reached in a causal way, so by traveling light-like or time-like, the bar doesn't mean the boundary, it means the completion. So if you take the causal future and then add to it its boundary, whatever that might be, and if you take the chronological future and add to it its boundary, whatever that might be, that's going to be the same, because in the bulk, I mean, you will see it in the picture in a moment. But in general, we will have that and that's the crucial equation that allows us to detect singularities later on. We have that the causal future of a set of events S, so the set of all events that can be reached on light-like or time-like paths, is not equal to the completion of, or the closure of the chronological future of the same set of events. In general, that's bigger than that. Let's see how that comes about. Basically, the difference is the shadow of singularities. Here's an example. Imagine there is our event P. It is replacing our S. So S could be a whole set of events, but let's just choose S to be one event P. Then we have here the light cone of it. And I plus of P is the chronological future of the event. So it's a set of all those events that can be reached by time-like curves. Curves that the chronometer could travel. That's why it's called the chronological future. So that's the inside of that wedge here. That's the chronological future of the event P. Now, let's look at what this closure of that set is. It's an open set, the inside of that. But when we close it, then we get the boundary here as well, right? It's like take an open set and you add the boundary of it, make it a closed set. That's what we get here. However, imagine now that there's a hole in the manifold. For some reason, later we will identify these reasons as a singularity, for example. Imagine that there is a hole in the manifold. In this case, considering the completion of this set, of the future, the chronological future of our event, the completion will give us this, will give us that, will give us this, but will not give us that point because this is not actually a point of the manifold. So what we have is that in particular, this point Q here, which is on that boundary, is an element of the closure of Rafael.
I lost my coat somewhere.
Your what?
My coat.
Oh.
Is that it? Oh, there.
Got it? Great. All right, so the point I want to make is that all the points here, such as this point, all the points here are part of the completion of the set I plus. Because just if you think about it mathematically, that's a certain set. The completion will give you the boundary of the set as well. So that point will also be given there. However, this point Q is not in here. It's not in here because this set is the set of all events that can be reached by P on curves that are either time-like or light-like. Now, if you want to go from here to there, then you have to travel at the speed of light. But you can't because the manifold has a hole here. So all of this is in the shadow of that singularity. Therefore, these events are not in J plus of S. However, they are in the completion I plus of S. You see, in principle, of course, you could go around it, But you can't do that in a time-like or light-like way. You would have to go space-like. You would have to, at some point, exceed 45 degrees. So these events are not in J plus of S. So this idea here, this observation that there are curves which can or cannot be extended further, this idea of possibly detecting singularities can be pursued and will work. So the idea is, let us use the inextendability or extendability of curves, or especially of geodesics, as an indicator for the absence or existence of a singularity. So we start with the definition, and first we will look at the case where we do not have a singularity, where it's not a problem, and then distinguish that from the case where we do. So we say that a point P is a future or past endpoint of a curve gamma. So we have a path. This is our trajectory here. And it may be a geodesic or may not be geodesic. And the parameter could be some parameter that we make up. We say that a point P over here is a future endpoint of our curve gamma if, for all neighborhoods of the point P, there exists a time, a parameter time, from which onwards the path gamma of t stays within that neighborhood. This is not indicating the presence of a singularity. This simply means that we have chosen to parameterize our geodesic in such a way that even though the parameter of the geodesic, or curve in general, even though the parameter keeps increasing and increasing and increasing, our actual geodesic just keeps slowing down, slowing down, slowing down, converging towards a point that we will call the endpoint of our curve. And you see, the manifold could be perfectly smooth around there. It's just saying that this is an endpoint of a curve. The endpoint P need not actually be reached. It could be that our path is such that it just asymptotically reaches that point. Actually, I think this might be a good time to take a break for 5 or 10 minutes, because we're slightly changing topics here now and trying to identify the singularity. Okay. Shall we take a break until 5 past? Okay. Yes.
Is this a parametrization dependent statement? Like, I can think of like my curve I parametrize badly and.
Yes, it is. That's right. Yes. So the curve is defined as the map from the real line into the manifold. It's not just the total image of it. It's okay. It's the way that it's parametrized.
So it cares about whether I choose the correct parametrization, like a nice parametrization of the curve.
It does, yes. Yes, you see, this is a curve that is extendable. We can take that path and then work on our way of parametrizing things, and then we can extend that curve to go on. Whereas if there is a singularity, we cannot.
So this is some kind of like a removable singularity?
Yes, like, yes. Okay. Yeah, it's not even a singularity. It's just an endpoint.
Achronal set,
yes.
Right? Could two events, for example, a supernova going on in the universe and something going on inside a black hole, would those two events constitute a part of that subset?
They could. If they're space-like separated from each other, space-like or,
right,
or light-like, then yes.
Because if you're inside the black hole, you can't really you know, interact with a supernova that's happening outside the black hole, right?
Oh, you're talking about the inside of a black hole.
Yeah, inside.
Yeah, but you can have events that are space-like to each other from within the black hole or some other place outside.
Are there any other, like, examples?
Yeah, sure. You could take the events in this room at the snapshot in time. They will be space-like to each other. And so that gives you an achronal set. And then let's say that while we take that snapshot, somebody switches on their phone and light rays go out. And then you look at all the events consisting of the snapshot in time of that room, plus all the events caused by the light rays traveling. And that's achronal as well,
yeah.
Because it's space-like plus light-like.
There's one. I have another question regarding the very, very early part of the slide, which is when you say that I have time orientability if I have a non-vanishing global time-like vector field that
That's
I
right.
can put on the space-time.
Yes.
But is that the same as being able to write the manifold as R cross something? Because it looks like if I have this vector field, then I can just draw one line along one curve and let it be the parameterization.
No, very good. But we will later see what it takes to have a cosmic time. Basically, what you're talking about is a cosmic time. And we will later see what it takes to have a cosmic time.
Well, so it's actually not enough.
Mm. It's good to have a break.
I already gave a lecture of 1.5 hours this morning.
Oh, the quantum one?
Huh?
The quantum theory one?
Yeah, the quantum theory one. Quantum theory two.
really like to cover it. And it works in a complementary fashion to what we do here. Here we say singularities can be recognized by the inextendability of curves. They've run into the singularity, and I just, even if I tried, I cannot extend it. But there's an alternative approach, which is to say, what if I have waves that wash over my space-time, that travel over the space-time? Now, a wave, when it crashes into a singularity, will not just get stalled and stay and sit there, right? So while a traveler might, I mean, you may want to write down a trajectory, and then it runs into a singularity, you cannot continue it. A wave is a global thing. If it encounters a singularity, in principle, it just keeps going. But there are two kinds of behaviors that waves can have when they travel on a space-time and they encounter a singularity. Namely, waves can just wash over the singularity as if there was nothing. That happens, in particular, if you take your space-time and you just by hand remove a point. In this case, it's a totally removable singularity. And then if you have a wave washing over that, which could be a Klein-Gordon wave or electromagnetic wave or something like that, it will indeed simply not care. However, if you have a substantial singularity, for example, a curvature singularity, we'll later see how they are defined, then what can happen is, doesn't always happen, but can happen, that in order to calculate what, in order to be able to calculate what the wave will do when encountering that, you have to impose boundary conditions. So you can then identify the presence of singularities by the need to impose boundary conditions on your wave equations to be able to tell how the future evolution is going to be. And so instead of looking at the extendability or inextendability of paths, you would look then at the differential operators that occur in the wave equation. And the Green's function associated with that wave equation. And if you remember from quantum field theory, Green's function, or electromagnetism, Green's function sometimes require the specification of boundary conditions. And singularities can require extra boundary conditions to be imposed. So the mathematics of singularities can also be formulated as the mathematics of the behavior of waves when they encounter such singularities. And interestingly, the definition of singularities by means of trajectories does not coincide with the definition of singularities as seen by waves. There can be singularities that are fatal for travelers, but that are fine for waves, for example. If you want to look up on this, the term that's used for that is quantum singularities. By that, they mean singularities as seen by waves. I think one of the main authors in that area is called Hurwitz or Horowitz, something similar to that. I hope that Google can autocomplete it in the right way, Google Scholar. Okay, so we said here we are going to check for the presence of singularities by checking the extendability or non-extendability of paths. And before we went for the break, we discussed that there could be that our curve has an endpoint, but the endpoint was self-imposed. We simply chose to end the curve there. We parameterized the curve in such a way that it ended there. It might asymptotic, it might actually literally end at a point P, or it might just approach the point P as the parameter goes to infinity. Either way, we call that point P an endpoint. So we say that the point P is a future endpoint of a curve gamma if for all neighborhoods around that point P, for all neighborhoods U, there exists a time, and by time I mean the parameter of our trajectory. It doesn't have to be literally the time. So there exists some parameter value t naught such that gamma, our curve, remains inside that neighborhood forever for all parameter values larger than t naught. So a point P is called an endpoint if, no matter how small a neighborhood we choose around this point, there's going to be a time, parameter time, from which onwards our curve will remain in that neighborhood. Okay, so P, the endpoint, may or may not be reached by the curve. It just has to be approached in the limit. Now, since in our case here, the point P is an element of the manifold, it is always possible to extend our curve gamma in a continuous fashion beyond P. Why is that? Well, remember that by the definition of a manifold, every point has epsilon neighborhoods around it. And therefore, for every point on the manifold, including the endpoint of our curve, there's always, in principle, a way to extend our trajectory to a little bit beyond that point P that we had previously identified as the endpoint. We can change the parameterization of our trajectory such that we go a little bit further into that open neighborhood. So even if a manifold has a finite volume, it's got to be open, right? If you think of a two-dimensional manifold, for example, it shouldn't have the boundary elements. It should be open. So for every point, and therefore, for that reason, it's a subtle reason, but for that reason, every point of the manifold has some neighborhood around it. And so there's always the possibility to extend our trajectory. Is that the time to update Java? I'm not sure. We can always extend it a little bit. So the existence of an endpoint here indicates not that there is a singularity. It doesn't indicate that there's a hole in the manifold. It merely indicates that we chose to end the curve before it was necessary. So now we define that a curve gamma is future or past inextendable if it does not possess a future or past endpoint. Because if it did possess a future endpoint, then it would be extendable by what we just said. Okay, so let me repeat this. If a curve has an endpoint, like a future endpoint, I mean, the whole thing can also be done with running towards the past, but let's just specialize to the case of running towards the future. So if a curve has a future endpoint, then we can always extend it a little bit because of the nature of a manifold. And we say that if it does not possess an endpoint, a curve, then it is called inextendable. Because we know that if it does possess an endpoint, then by the nature of manifold or having open sets, it would be extendable. All right, so we say it's inextendable if it does not possess an endpoint. But why would it be inextendable? Well, it could be any one of these reasons. For now, I will do it intuitively, but we'll do it more accurately in a moment. So if a curve gamma is future inextendable, so in other words, if it does not possess an endpoint, okay, so it does not possess an endpoint, then it could be that our curve doesn't possess an endpoint because it just keeps going. It's a very trivial case. It's like you have a curve, it might be the world line of a spaceship, and that spaceship just keeps going forever. Well, it won't have an endpoint at the trajectory. It just keeps traveling forever, and that's why it has no endpoint. And that trajectory is not extendable. It's already going to infinity, can't extend beyond that. So that's kind of a trivial case, but we have to cover it. So curves without endpoints, so-called inextendable curves, are curves, for example, that run simply to infinity. But it could also be a curve that runs around forever, that just goes in a circle forever. Right? It doesn't stretch all over to infinity, but no, it just goes around in a loop or something, and then it closes into itself. Those curves are not going to infinity, but they also don't have an endpoint because they just keep going, so they're also called inextendable. And then there's the case that is of interest to us, which could be that a curve gamma hits a hole. It hits a singularity. And therefore, it cannot be continuously extended. So it could be that our curve is traveling here on the manifold, and then we would like to extend it here, but we can't because the manifold simply, there is nothing of the manifold. There is a hole in the manifold. There is no point into which we could continuously extend the path. So that's the case that is of interest here. Now, assume that we have a subset C of the manifold, which is closed. And let's assume that Q is an element of the boundary of the chronological future of C. And let's assume that Q is not itself in the set C. The theorem says that Q then lies on a null geodesic gamma inside of the boundary of the chronological future of C. And the curve gamma does one of two things. It either A has a past endpoint on our set C, or B, it is past inextendable because it meets a hole or a singularity. So this is a bit abstract. Here's the picture for that. So we have a subset of the manifold C, and here I'm drawing that. And we consider now the chronological future of it. That's all of this. All of this set of events. This is the set of events that can be reached from C by time-like curves, by actual chronometers, by actual objects. And we look at the boundary of that, which is this and that. Remember that taking the boundary means that we will get all those events. Remember, they were not in I. They would be in J, but they are not in I, because I doesn't allow time-like travel, light-like travel, so that they wouldn't be. But we take the boundary of it, and then we get that set. And here, too, we have all those elements in I plus. The boundary of this open set contains these points as well as those points, because it's just a matter of topology to generate the boundary. It has nothing to do with causality, so we get all those events, and we get all those events as well. So if we now take and point in that boundary, then that point could lie either in here, or there, or there. Now, if the point was here, if Q was here, then it would be case A. It has a past endpoint on C. Namely, we can write down a trajectory that runs towards the past onto C and has an endpoint there. We can definitely do this. Also, if Q was over here somewhere, then too, it would be case A. It has a past endpoint on C. We can write down a trajectory which is light-like, which runs backwards and has an endpoint right here on C. But if we choose our point Q over here, then it will be case B. Because now we have paths that start from Q and travel it towards the past, but are not extendable here because the manifold has a hole. Simply is the points missing here. So we have a past inextendable curves here. So the strategy then is to study inextendable curves. And these includes several cases again. Well, the three cases that we discussed earlier, namely the inextendable curves. Well, we had ordered them earlier in a different way. That was our first case. Gamma is running off to infinity. That is one possibility why a curve doesn't have an endpoint. Is inextendable, therefore. Another possibility is that the curve is just going round and round forever. That also makes it inextendable. Or it hits a singularity, and that's the case we are interested in. Now, before we can move on to the interesting case A, which is ultimately where we want to have theorems about, we run again into the extreme weirdness that general relativity does allow. Namely, general relativity allows, in principle, the case of C, which is time travel, which is that a curve is going round and round forever. And that, of course, leads to potential issues with causality, killing your grandfather and things like that. So we have to address these causality problems of the case C before we can move on to case A that we're really interested in. So here's a picture of what might happen in a space-time that general relativity allows. Here is a closed curve, and it would be a future-oriented time-like curve that we are traveling here. And I'm plotting here the forward light cones. And you see, in this case, you could be born here and then come back and kill your parents or something like that, right? So this would be super weird. But notice that this is different from the circle that I had drawn at the beginning of this lecture, where the question was time orientability. Time orientability is not an issue here. It is well defined everywhere where the future is and where the past is. This is not about time orientability, what the direction towards the future is and what the direction towards the past is well defined. Here the issue is that you can actually travel back in time. That's a different issue. So we'll need to treat this case C separately. And I think we are basically running out of time. Let me just give you a brief preview of what we're going to do next. Namely, we're going to study closed time-like curves, time travel. And we will say that this is a case to be avoided. But it can happen that we avoid it, and we're still not happy with it. And the reason is that it could be that we have a space-time in which closed time-like curves are forbidden. I shouldn't say forbidden, simply not existent. We could have a space-time in which closed space-like curves, closed time-like curves, so time travel, is not possible. There are no closed time-like curves. But it could be that this space-time is very, very, very close to having closed time-like curves. That would be a situation like this. You know, like we had here. A situation like this carousel here, except that it's not exactly closing. So we actually have this picture here. So light cones like this going around our Coke can. And then they tilt, and then they tilt, and they are almost at the 45 degrees. We are almost having this picture that you can do a closed time-like curve. But instead, if you go around the can, you're not exactly back at the same point. You're a little bit lifted up. So it's not a closed time-like curve. And therefore, in principle, logically, it's fine. But we should not be content with this, because it would mean that small perturbations might screw things up. And suddenly, we do have time travel. And so what we will then study is the stability of causality. So what does it take to ensure that not only we don't have closed time-like curves, no time travel, but also we are separated from the ability to do time travel by some finite amount in some sense. So that if, for example, quantum fluctuations don't get us into that regime. And then once we've settled all that stuff, then we come back and identify singularities and develop singularity theorems and show that supernovas really will lead to singularities. I mean, that there's a generic possibility to get singularities and so on. But I think we are really out of time for today. Okay, so that's where we'll pick up again on Thursday.